Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Well, thank you, Howard. Yes, we are back here at the great little booth in the corner of Skip Page's Little Bar for another edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. Slightly diminished conversation. Our dear friend Randy, my co-host, spiritual guru, could not be here. He had a death in the family. John McMullen, our producer, is here. Hello, John.
Hello. I thought that he said not a death in the family, but I thought that it was that he was supposed to be going through obedience training with
Butters?
Butters.
That's true.
Getting ready for the big kennel club dog show.
I think Butters is very well behaved. I think it's Randy who needs obedience training.
But that's why he had to go in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that he can't be here, but I'm delighted to have our guest here. This is a gentleman who I've been hounding to be on the podcast since I met him, gosh, probably a year ago at this point.
Almost,
or close to
yeah.
it. Baratunde Thurston is our guest, and I don't even know how to describe, author, comedian.
Sometimes.
Host.
Yes.
Husband.
Citizen.
Citizen. You do a podcast, How to Citizen.
I do. And the way I'll help you out on that, because it's been challenging to everybody outside of me for my whole life to describe what I do, including my own wife.
Well, you do so many different things. You wear so many different hats.
But it's ultimately one thing.
Okay.
I'm a storyteller. I tell stories about how we can live well together across three major areas. How do we live well with the earth? How do we live well with our fellow humans in this thing called democracy? How do we live well with technology and the machines? And so you can find my work in those arenas, PBS show, America Outdoors, democracy leaning show, How to Citizen, and the big tech AI moment show right now, Life with Machines. But ultimately, I want a good future for everybody. And I think we have to get these three areas in some better balance.
You've made that your focus, and AI obviously is having a moment, and you're diving right into this. So let's start there.
Sure.
With Life with Machines. What, there are so many naysayers and doomsday predictors around AI. It's going to take everybody's job. It's going to become Skynet and destroy us all. Where are you? I see you as a very optimistic human being. So
oh, boy. Prepare, Patrick, to be disappointed. This keeps our listeners on their toes. Now, what is he about to say?
Oh, my goodness. Holy cow.
But so yes, I am generally optimistic.
I want your hot take on AI, and give me the premise behind your Life with Machines program.
Yeah. Thank you. And just thanks for having me. It's good to be here. I'm a newish resident of the Coachella Valley. My wife, Elizabeth, and I did
a conference. The city of Palm Springs did an AI kind of
That's right.
thing, and you were one of the keynote speakers.
Yes.
And I ran into you. Bar Issy, I think, is where I ran into you.
Yeah, I ran into, John, is such a kind reframe, where you accosted me, pursued me aggressively, hounded me on behalf of the media, and I appreciate it.
I did.
But I said yes. I'm here.
I'm usually not that aggressive, but I'm like, this dude is a cool dude.
And I was very sleep deprived and jet lagged. So against my full reasoning skills, I said yes.
You did say yes.
And here we are in a bar on a Monday afternoon.
And what people don't know is we did this once before and we lost
the whole thing. So. Thank you. Let us talk about our Life with Machines, shall we?
Yeah.
Shall we talk about-
Our machine ate our last
conversation. Our machine failed. And it's a meta of the micro, because- There was a failure of power here in the bar. There's some work going on, and the machine was not able to maintain the recording. And so we all shed a tear for that lost media. But we're in a moment now where AI requires a lot of power, literally. A lot of communities are upset about that, a lot of negativity around that. So yeah, you and I met at the Palm Springs AI and Creativity Expo, heavily organized by my friend and neighbor, Peter Lafort, and the Tech Steering Committee of Palm Springs, of which I am a member. And so that idea was, how does a community face this challenge and opportunity together, and not just individuals of us figuring out what app, my job, my individual job, what about my kid, what about this and that? How about we all come together as business owners, as residents, as older and younger people, and ask what's going on, how it can serve us, where we're alarmed, and what are we going to do about it? So a lot of gratitude to Peter, because he's ultimately why I even know you and why you stalked me all the way to Bar Easy from the Palm Springs Convention Center, which is not that close. So you really,
it's not. It was,
you were focused, and I respect it.
Very focused.
So yeah, I grew up, my mom was a coder. I was born in 1977, raised in D.C.
You were, yeah, like Northwest.
The neighborhood is Mount Pleasant.
Mount Pleasant.
I think of it as the best neighborhood in the country. Yeah. And it's still one of the top places you could be. It's very multi-everything, and people get along, and people look out for each other. There's a sense of interdependence and community there, and that certainly shaped me, even with the challenge of drugs and crime and all that, people had each other's backs. So my mom never graduated college, but she was really committed to bettering herself, to bettering the family and the community. So she took me out into the woods and made me a Boy Scout, and we went camping with me and my friends. She loved the earth. She took me to my first rallies as a very small person, trained me up on elements of democracy, and went to community meetings with her. And she brought a computer home from her government job.
So you grew up with technology.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy, because some people who are nature lovers,
yeah,
are that.
Yeah.
And sort of eschew, yeah, the technology. My wife is sort of like that.
Okay.
I wouldn't say a technophobe.
Yeah. But not a technophile.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. But, yeah, you know, she's a camper. She's a hiker.
Mm.
She loves nature. She wants to be around it. But the moment I bring an Alexa-empowered device into the home, she's upset about it.
So is my wife. Elizabeth says, you know, keep her out of here. And I'm like, we're talking about a machine. Keep her out of here. I don't want her listening in to our conversation.
Luddites.
And she's probably keeping us safe at the same time. So I have my own little studio room, and Alexa and I have occasionally spoken there, though lately I haven't been messing with Alexa too much. But started for me with mom. And tech has been a big part of my whole life. When I worked for The Onion, which is my proudest job yet in this life, is still having 5 years at America's Finest News.
You were the digital editor of The Onion.
Let's make the title more lofty,
I'm sorry,
please, sir.
You were
director of digital.
Director of digital.
A title I created for myself for moments just like
just
this.
Just like this.
I was hired as web editor. I became director of digital.
Web editor. That's not even a thing.
Exactly. I'm not editing HTML on the website, guys. We're doing something different here.
You're Harvard educated.
I am. And Harvard is Baratunde educated. It was mutual. I taught them a few things.
You gave them back as much as they gave you?
I believe in bilateral relationships.
All right. So we'll go back to life with machines, but I want to get you. Well, loved your time at The Onion.
I loved my time at The Onion. It remains the best job I've ever had. I've had a lot of jobs at this state in my life, but it was funny, mm-hmm, right? I going to The Onion was like going to grad school for comedy and satire in particular. And I was surrounded by a community of people who knew how to work well together and who didn't have a ton of ego. And I think there's a lot of prominent comedy institutions where it's very competitive, and it's all about who gets more credit, who gets more face time, mic time, stage time between you two. It's clearly like, Patrick, you've crushed John Sol to a fine
pulp. I've had to fend him off.
He barely says a word now.
He's a shadow of the man he used to be.
Gosh, for Randy's not even allowed here.
He didn't show up. I mean, he won't even come.
So outside of big conversations at this little bar, there's another way to do it. And I was really lucky to be brought into The Onion. I came in sideways, very competitive. There were 200 people vying for this job when I applied for it. So luck played a huge part as well. I believe I was talented, and I know I was lucky. And I got to be in this community of funny professionals. I got compensated poorly. I got average health insurance, but I was overpaid in education. And it was the best working years of my life. And I run my own business now. I think The Onion was better from the perspective of how dense it was in terms of the amount that I learned from Todd Hanson, one of our greatest writers, not just at The Onion, in American cultural life that you probably never heard of, but Todd is the man, and it was just an incredible institution to be a part of. So loved my time at The Onion, did a lot of internet things and political things. And
well, it was always so, it remains so cutting edge.
Yeah.
And there's stuff, I see Onion headlines, and then I have to actually go back and research what the satire is.
Yeah.
Like, I learn things from The Onion because, like, I know that's probably really funny. I just need to find out why.
Well,
and then I go back and I'm like, oh, no, that's hilarious.
It is. It tests you, and reality is testing The Onion, right? So a New York Times headline could be an Onion headline from a decade ago.
Yes.
Because we are competing with the absurdity of the imagination of a good satirical comedic mind. And that's not a compliment, my fellow Americans. By the way, like we don't, this is a competition reality should not win. We should cede satire to the comedians and the artists and the satirists and let the real world be a little less boring, a little less exciting, a little more boring.
Yeah. And not as
long
absurd.
Live The Onion. And I'm also really happy since I left, I left in 2012. So they've gone through a huge evolution, a move to Chicago, a couple of changes in ownership, and the new owners, I'm excited. They're ridiculous. They get the brand and the voice. It's like Global Tetrahedron Corporation. They made a vow to buy Alex Jones's Prison Planet.
Oh, right.
And
yeah,
his whole weird media ecosystem. And they have invested. The print edition is back. So I'm a print subscriber to The Onion every month. Paper shows up in my mailbox with hilarious fake news on it. Not the kind that destroys our democracy, but the kind that makes us stronger together. And yeah, I've met a few of them, and I'm just glad it's in good hands.
If you had the opportunity, would you go back?
Ooh. I feel like you're asking me if I'd run for president. I'm
like, I was going to do
never
that
say never.
I was going to do that later in the podcast.
Depending on how much I spend more time with my family, what are the things? I don't see myself having a job in the way that I had a job when I was there. But it'd be an honor to work with them.
You're making your own jobs these days.
I am. And when will this drop? How much time between this recording and the publication?
About an hour. Literally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to come out almost immediately.
Well, then I'll loosely tease something. I am about to launch, it's not a huge thing, but I will be doing a creative project in partnership with The Onion.
Oh, very cool.
Imminently.
Okay.
And it's related to AI and our technological future. And it's not
me. Are they creating an AI Baratunde?
So see, I'm really, if I tell you, I will have to kill you and feed your bones to the machine
wow,
to power the next data center.
That's dark, but now I really want the answer.
I don't want that for you. I know you have people who love you. It just doesn't feel like the end you deserve or that they ask for.
Yeah, but you know, the headline, you know.
It would be a great
headline. Thursday.
And The Onion is nothing if not great headline.
Kills podcast host. Steve's his bonus to the machines. And you would get content for Life with Machines. You'd be like,
that's right.
Also, this is the sequel, Death with Machines.
Pretty good. Pretty good. All right. We got to keep doing this. By the way, I'm just going to check 15 times. Are we recording?
Yeah, the power's still
excellent.
On.
Yeah.
The light's red.
I see the red light. The buttons are aglow, but I just want to make sure it's real.
All right, so teasing, you're going to be collaborating with The Onion. And that was 2012, doesn't feel like it was that long ago, but you've really changed and evolved, and they've gone through big changes.
Yeah.
So.
And so we all have, the nation, the earth, everything's
all right.
Different.
So that was your favorite job.
Yeah.
Now you make your own jobs.
Yeah.
I want to get back to this Life with Machines.
Sure, yeah, let's do
it. And I want to...
Because you asked my hot take, and I did an effective job of dodging that, though.
You did. You completely... I mean, we went off on a 15-minute tangent, but we're back, because I'm very focused.
I see that. You're wearing a tie.
This is
no podcast interview in my life has the host worn a tie. Just for the record.
Well, my day job, I'm sure you know this. Maybe you don't. I'm the meteorologist for the ABC station. So I had to wear a tie for that. They make me dress up.
It's very humid today, by the way.
It's really humid.
Wow.
And it's going to be cloudy and it's going to maybe sprinkle on us a little bit. Then it's going to get really windy and then it's going to be beautiful for the end of the week.
Okay. Thank you.
84.
That's actually why I came here. Oh. So I got what I needed.
There you go.
Thank you, John, for inviting me. I'll see you all later.
I'm not going to let you dodge this.
All right.
As you said.
AI. Here's AI, the take.
The perils.
Yes.
What are the perils that you see?
All right. What I didn't establish, Life with Machines is a show. We do it on Substack, YouTube, Instagram, and your audio podcast feeds like this show. Our goal is to explore how do we live well with tech and not just endure it. That's the mission.
Okay.
Let's live well with technology and not just endure it.
See, I embrace it. I love technology.
I do too. And I love people and I love trees and I love life. And I think there's, you know, we got to do these things in balance.
Right.
I think there's a lot of folks, not saying you're this, but I know many of the people really pushing AI at us, they only love technology, but they actually don't love the experience of life.
I think their goal is
let's just speed everything up and let's make everything efficient. And I don't want, what are you drinking right now?
This is called a Xanadu.
Xanadu.
It's made with mezcal.
Heck yeah. See, so that should not be sped up, right? We don't need to make cocktails more efficient or the consumption of them, right? Maybe people could make them a little faster if the bar is crowded. You want an extra hand behind the bar. But your enjoyment of this handcrafted, beautiful, plant-based beverage, that's how I think of mezcal. I love mezcal, is not something that needs to be optimized. And so when you ask me, what do I think the perils are? I think one of the deepest perils is that we will become machines. Not that machines will take over everything from us, but that we will start to optimize every area of our life, try to make the most meaningful things the fastest and most efficient, and we will suck the life out of life in effort to keep up with someone else's idea of what life is supposed to be. That's the biggest fear. I'm concerned about misinformation, what happens with our young people, what happens with our democracy, power use, and all, there's a lot of stuff, but at the core, I think I'm most worried that we haven't set the right goal for this technology, that not enough of us have been involved in setting that goal. And so we're just going to be having our lives sucked out of us in service of machines. And
I feel like one of the reasons we haven't done a good job of setting a goal, I don't think we know enough about it. And so I think your show,
yeah,
and shows like yours are really important because we need to be better educated about what AI can do for us,
yeah,
and what it should do for us and what it shouldn't do for us.
Yeah.
And I think, and I don't see policymakers at the national level really grasping the necessity to put some guardrails up.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's necessarily true, but it feels
catching up, but the speed of the people pushing AI is moving faster.
Yeah.
And there's a few things I want people to try to remember from this conversation about AI. Let's start with, what is AI? All right, it's just two letters. We throw it out there a lot. And for most people, it means ChatGPT or something like it.
Right.
And that is not nearly a complete enough answer. Stands for artificial intelligence. Really, it's about machine learning. There's a high-level goal by many people promoting this to create thinking machines, and explicitly by people like Sam Altman of OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, to create artificial general intelligence, where a machine is capable of all economically viable human work. That's their explicit goal. They wrote it on the website. So this is where the ship is pointed right now.
Right.
And then, so I want all of us to ask, like, is that what we want? And because that's where the incentives, that's where the investors are expecting, that's how they're measuring themselves. And there's a lot of what AI is. AI is autocomplete in your text messages. It is the ability to identify faces in your photo albums. It is spell check.
There's a case that just happened last week.
Yes.
Where a woman was misidentified.
Mm.
And she was arrested.
Yep.
And for bank fraud. But it was AI misidentified her.
Yeah.
And they were finally able to prove that she was never anywhere where this could have taken place. But so AI is fallible.
It is.
That's older AI technology. We've had facial recognition technology for a long time.
We have. But that's such a good reference. And I thought you were going to say something different. So I thought you were going to talk about the case of Meta and YouTube in the lawsuits about their harm to children through their algorithms, which is also AI.
Right.
Your social media feed
AI. It's learning what you like so that it can keep you going.
And it sucks people into rabbit holes that they shouldn't be sucked into. Yeah. Even kids at schools given these Chromebooks. Seems like a generous offer, but there's YouTube on that and the algorithm is amoral. And so a kid who might be starting there with a science assignment might end up in some really toxic and harmful stuff paid for by all of us.
Right.
And that's, again, is that our collective goal? Do we want that? Does a school superintendent really want that? So AI is a collection of technologies. Chatbots are one subset. These large language models underneath these chatbots, where they predict the next token, that's the slightly more technical way, but they essentially do really fancy autocomplete. And it's so fancy and convincing that it's also useful. But there are other ways to do AI. And so that's just high level clarification. The next thing is,
when we, I want us to be really clear with the language that AI itself generally isn't doing much. I've been trying to be careful saying the people who run these companies want.
Right.
They say that their goal for this is. And so I'm not afraid of AI. I'm not.
But you're afraid of the people.
I am potentially afraid of the people. I'm definitely in strong disagreement with some of the people. And the holding of it is I use AI technologies every day, sometimes involuntarily through social media, often very consciously through a product like Claude from Anthropic, which is parallel to ChatGPT. And I get great value from it. It's helped me in my home life. I'm not a home contractor. I never owned a home before living in Palm Springs. How to fix an HVAC, how to compare bids. I don't know. My dad wasn't around when I was a kid. My mom didn't know that stuff. I had no tutoring in it. And I can spend a lot of time on Reddit and I can watch a lot of YouTube videos. And I've done some of that. And I can ask this bot and they're so helpful. And I've saved thousands of dollars. That's like a tangible, practical
thing.
Okay,
that's a really...
Where I'm just like, my life is better. My bank account has more money than it would have. And my house has hot water and cool air, which is really, really important to living in the modern era.
It is.
Yeah.
You said something that resonated with me for a second. And I want to circle back.
Okay.
You said the technology is amoral. I grew up a science fiction fan.
Mm.
And I was a big Isaac Asimov buff.
Me too. Foundation, baby.
And Isaac Asimov, in fact, as a kid, I wrote him a letter and he actually wrote me back.
What?
Yeah. I have two signed letters from Isaac Asimov. One was, I sent you a letter already, so stop writing it. Which, that was the last one.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, it was terrific.
that's the one that gets framed.
Yeah. But he created the three laws of robotics.
Yes.
And he instilled in these fictitious robots,
mm-hmm.
wasn't necessarily morality, but they were not able to harm a human. Is there the potential for us to provide AI with morality?
I mean, you're cutting right to the heart of it, man. I love Isaac Asimov. There have been calls, and even in his own work, there was the reference to a zeroth law to precede the first three laws of robotics. And it's not in my head right now. And I even wrote something in our Life with Machines Substack, plug, about it. I have to research my own thoughts because they're not always present. But we will need to embed more of a sense of ethics and morals into these increasingly thoughtful machines. And I think because you used the word guardrails earlier, guardrails are very important. And we have imbued these tools with so much power and they're on an accelerating curve of capabilities that I do not believe that guardrails alone are going to keep us all in a good, balanced, safe world. I think we've already seen people abusing their access to AI to weaponize them against people, just rhetorically, but also to develop weapons or explosive devices and things like that. So I think we're going to end up more in a relationship with these entities. I'm not calling them lives. I'll just say entities to keep it vague, but we already see AI in our org charts and work. People have AI doing jobs and they're farming out work to agents, technically agentic AI systems who themselves have sub-agents. So little digital bots have little digital bots underneath of them that are reporting back to them.
Wow.
And those are existing within an org chart of a human organization. So AI will end up in our org charts. They'll end up in our friend networks. We've seen that. We've seen people falling in love with chatbots,
yes,
and avatars and having relationships.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, and this is far out there, so none of this is advocacy. It's an attempt at spotting where I think we're going. We will end up with AI in our family trees. Those relationships will become established, maybe as pets initially. The way you got Scruffy or Fido, they're in your family. A lot of people consider their dogs part of their family. Well, even though
absolutely.
So when we're going that way, I reference an author and one of the people who helped create Google Translate. His name is Dekai, D-E-K-A-I. He has a book called Raising AI. And he's encouraging us to have a metaphor of seeing this more like parenting than like controlling software. There's limits to it, right? AI is not flesh and blood. It is not born of us. There's no beating heart. It's very arguable if there's a soul in there. That's a theological, philosophical question. But I'm going to say no. And it is built from observation of us. It is trained on a lot of our emissions, our blog posts, our photos, our speech patterns.
Yeah, it swims in the pool of our own data.
So it has learned from our collective experience. English speaking, heavily Western world, a lot of caveats on it. It's not the whole human experience, but it's a lot. It's enough to convince people to fall in love with it and have it do real work for real money, which is fake. So all of that says, how do we then create a healthy relationship with AI? How do we show it the best of us, not just the worst of us or whatever happens to be on Reddit, so that the mirror it reflects back to us is what we want to see and what we want to encourage in the world?
There are always going to be those people, unscrupulous people,
yeah,
who will want to use it to prey on other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, as much as we have this lofty goal of creating a relationship and raising AI, yeah, they're bad seeds out there. So, and unfortunately, we can't, it's not like our raising our own kids where we have some control over who they spend time with, at least for a little while.
Yeah.
Like AI gets to spend time with everybody.
But I actually take the opposite lesson from your exact same metaphor.
Okay.
So let's substitute AI for people in the story. There's always going to be people out there with ill intent who want to cause destruction. They want to hurt someone. They want to take advantage. They want to scam or steal or somehow deceive and create harm in the world. Maybe because they're sick, or maybe because there's something in it for them. And this is the way they know how to get ahead in life, and they weren't raised the best. But collectively, we take responsibility for that. We have police forces who keep an eye out for all of us. We have medical professionals who help heal injured folks through fault and no fault accidents. We have educators, we have pastors, we have crossing guards, we have regulators, and all kinds of other participants in the system to say the behavior of a human is in some level the collective responsibility of all humans. Even while we have individual will and choice, we've created all these institutions to take responsibility for each other. And that opportunity, I think, is a good precedent. I think we have good evidence that it works mostly.
It does work.
It works, I mean, mostly.
They're
still crying.
Yes.
But you know, it's certainly, we're doing a lot better than no schools, no law, no church, no golf club, no little bar. And so we need something. We need that same energy, I think, for the people who've been sitting on the sidelines of the AI conversation and saying, I'm not that into tech. This doesn't concern me. Your electricity bill concerns you. And AI and the promotion of it affects that. The availability of water affects you. And I would say the experience of the human beings around you affects you. So if your child or the young person in your life is getting sucked into some weird AI relationship, now AI affects you, even if you never log in to a ChatGPT-like system.
Right.
So then we all need to think about, how do we want to get the best out of this? The same way we think, how do we want to get the best out of people? And then how do we want to limit the worst of it? The same way we want to limit the worst of people without having a total Orwellian control and surveillance state on everything and everyone. But where we are at now, we're doing almost nothing.
Right.
And the only people creating the sense of morality or guardrails are the same people making money off of it.
Right.
And we do not allow that anywhere else in our society. We don't just say, all right, drug makers alone, for-profit drug companies, but imagine a world or a county or a state or a country where that is. But seriously,
We do. I mean,
yeah.
There are regulations for just about everything else.
Absolutely.
But this is such new technology.
Yeah.
And I know we could finish the entire podcast on this, but I'm going to pivot.
Great.
But I love this. And if you guys want to hear more,
we'll do it again.
Life with Machines.
Life with Machines. Dot media. That's the website.
Life with machines.media. Yeah. Check it out. And especially if you're really, you know, interested in where AI is going and how we're utilizing it and
yeah.
how we're not regulating it. I think you're going to really enjoy what Maritunde has to say about this. I want to go back to a book you wrote.
Okay.
And I've not read it, but I feel like I need to at some point. How to Be Black.
Yes.
Tell me the genesis of that book for you and the goal when you sat down to write that.
Genesis of the book was being born black in 1977 when I came out of my mother's body. Amazing what women do to help bring life into this world. The genesis in my own consciousness of creating a book came out of frustration at the story of what it meant to be Black from different angles. From some of my fellow Black people, there was this idea that you're not Black enough if you don't meet certain conditions, if you weren't raised in a certain way, if you don't speak a certain way or have a certain cultural fluency. There were gatekeeping on race membership.
You mentioned in the discussion about the book,
yeah,
you took exception to people who spoke for every Black person.
Right. So I wrote a book called How to Be Black. So I could speak for
so
every
you could
Black
speak
person.
For everybody.
Yeah. I thought I could do it better. I wasn't in principle against the idea. I was annoyed that it wasn't
like what
me.
Had come before you. Yeah.
Let me do it. So it's pressure on the you're not Black enough side from certain Black people. And then there's pressure from the you're too Black side from non-Black people who felt threatened by Blackness, who always saw a Black person as less than or some kind of security risk. And this is these are experiences I've had, but they're also collective experiences that our nation has had and many parts of the world have had. So I thought, let me share my take on this through my own story. So it's a memoir. It's my coming of Blackness, as I describe it. I've shared a little bit of my mom's story with you already, mm-hmm. raised by this really unique, special, beautiful, powerful Black woman who had a lot of her own traumatic experiences of being a Black person and a woman on top of that.
And working in a field where very few women were.
Absolutely.
Let alone women
yeah.
of color.
And so she had a lot to put down on a list of grievances, and she had a beautiful life. And she shared both of these with me, to fight for justice and demand what's right and call out the BS, and to be grateful and know that you're worthwhile and love yourself and love others. And so this book is me sharing some of the wisdom that I learned on that journey, mostly from her, and then the communities I was a part of. And then I did a virtual kind of panel where I interviewed 7 people for their perspective on how to be Black. So it wasn't just me. I kid about that a little bit. My name is the byline, but the book features a lot of interviews with not me. And there were 6 different types of Black people who I was all friends with. Some were born in rural places on the Eastern Shore. Some were artists. Some were in business. One was actually born on the continent of Africa, who clearly like the Blackest among us. Everything in America is technically diluted just because of all of the things that we've been through. And I interviewed 1 white person, partially as a joke, because I wanted a control group and I thought this has to be scientifically sound and I wanted to survive peer review, but also because I wanted to demonstrate that race is not just something for Black people to deal with or people of color to deal with or minorities to deal with, that it affects the reality of all of us. And so I wanted to invite in a white person to sit at this hypothetical table and talk about, when did you first realize you were white? Which I was asking all the Black people, when did you first realize you were Black? And there's usually some dramatic, traumatic story of like being denied a service, being called out of your name, being told you're stupid because, or you lack something because attached to your race. And so Christian Lander is his name, the white person I brought in. He has a story of his own realization of whiteness. And that's an important part of the tapestry. So that's the book. Came out in 2012. Still in school districts. I was hoping it would be one of the books that got banned, but it didn't. Which means I didn't do my job.
We need to work harder. Yes. Second edition. We'll try to get this thing done. When did you realize you were Black?
Ooh. Couple of moments. I mean, my mother, I have a love and a hate version. So the love version is my mother taking me to beautiful Black cultural events in D.C., starting in our house, right? She had this artwork. She had an ankh on the wall. It's an ancient symbol from northern parts of Africa. And she was always trying to reflect what our culture might be. There was a poster, Africa is a continent, not a country, just as an affirmation and a reminder. So things like that she did right in the house and then taking me to these cultural things was you're Black and this is what it can be like. And this is the beauty of it. The negative, the hate side of that coin, I was on a camping trip in West Virginia. Told you my mom took me and my friends out into the woods. And first time I got called the N-word. And I think I was 7, maybe 8 years old. Me and my friend, Reginald. And I knew Reginald from Taekwondo class. And we were coming out of the water. And this kid on the shore was pointing in our direction and yelling, "There's N-words in the water. There's N-words in the water." And my first legitimate response was to look over my shoulder and be like, where? What is he talking about? And then it hit me like he's talking about us. And then it hit me, we could really kick this little boy's ass. Like, Reginald and I were coming up in the ranks pretty quick. I didn't see his family around, you know, so. And then it's like, that's a bad idea. First, violence, not good. But also, where we were in the rural mountainous areas of West Virginia, the consequences of even talking back to the little boy.
Right.
That was not an available choice, we felt. So we ate it. We just sucked it up and we went back to my mom. And I don't even know if we told her.
Wow.
I don't actually think I ever told my mother that story. It's in a book that everybody else has seen. she wasn't alive by the time the book came out. So I don't know if she knows that. I know she has worse versions of that same story herself, though. So, yeah. Positive and negative. Yeah.
Not helping West Virginia's reputation any.
No, but you know what? Let me do West Virginia a favor. I had this beautiful outdoor show. I got to return to West Virginia in an outdoor setting with PBS to make this show America Outdoors. Mm-hmm. And we spent a week there highlighting various relationships people have to the natural world. And I was blown away by just the physical beauty of the state.
It's gorgeous.
Punches above its reputation for sure, because West Virginia has become a joke for a lot of people, including me. And
so like in West Virginia, if you divorce your wife, she's still your sister.
Stuff like that.
That's just
and
a new job.
There's so much more going on there.
Did you go to
Hole and went? So
the New River Gorge.
I did. I was just about to tell the story. I went and did a Eric Thomas, maybe was his last name. He's a paraplegic, and he took me whitewater rafting down the New River Gorge in the first year that it was made a national park, and so we helped christen the river. And this is a very technically disabled person who is so capable of things that I can't do. I depended on him. Despite the fact that I can walk. And he's not paraplegic. That was a false description. He's paralyzed from the waist down. And so he can operate his arms and his upper body, but about mid-chest down, no control whatsoever. And I was safer in his hands than he was in mine.
Wow.
I visited with former coal miners who became beekeepers. And they've been on this healing journey of their relationship with mountains, which they used to blow up and rip apart to fuel our life, including AI. And now they're tending to life and nurturing bees and the honey that comes from them. And some of the best honey I've ever had was former coal miners become beekeepers out of the Appalachian Beekeepers Cooperative. And so many more stories. So today's headline about West Virginia is still not sophisticated. And the story I told at the beginning pairs nicely with this one, because I had a terrible experience in West Virginia as a child and a beautiful experience as an adult.
Yeah.
And I think that's life.
Right. Like, yes.
Thank you, West Virginia. I'm very pained by some of you, and I'm in love with some of you.
You know, I grew up in Virginia.
Yeah.
And I spent some time just visiting West Virginia. Mm. And it is, you know, it's all of its kind of core components, yeah. But it's more than that. So we're not picking on West Virginia.
No, and many of us would be so lucky, despite the poverty and the complexity of their politics, at the economic challenges, people in general of West Virginia have a sense of family and a sense of community cohesion because they've been looked down upon and overlooked so much. They've had to figure it out themselves. And even the ancestral history of the people who settled there, not to mention the indigenous people who've been there, but just the whiteness that settled there, the types of white people who ended up there were more mountain, more earth-loving, more connected to each other. Types of people.
Well, the kind of people, I mean, you think about what West Virginia was when people were migrating west, and a lot of people kept going.
Yeah.
Some people stopped and said, this holler is going to be my home. Yeah. And like, it took a real rugged human being to make that decision.
That's right.
In those days.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. And that's true. You know, I spent a lot of time in the western part of the state of Virginia, in Roanoke, Virginia.
Yeah. Okay.
And so,
we're basically neighbors.
We were basically neighbors. Yeah. Well, I spent some time. I grew up in Charlottesville.
Okay. Okay.
I spent some time in D.C. My dad actually worked for the EPA in its very early years.
Wow.
And people are always shocked when they find out that Richard Nixon, the Republican, created the EPA. Exactly. But he did.
Yeah.
My dad actually worked for the Nixon EPA.
Yeah.
And he did a lot. Well, he traveled around the globe doing pollution control work in Mexico City and in Los Angeles. And so,
wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. So is he the children of government workers?
That's Indeed. Growing up in D.C., you talked a little bit about it, but you love the sense of community and neighborhood that you grew up in.
Yeah.
But it was also a difficult place to grow up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different version of a West Virginia story we just went through. There was the neighborhood I grew up in, it's called Mount Pleasant. It's right on the border of a neighborhood called Columbia Heights. And I grew up at 16th and Newton Streets in the northwest part of town. So anybody wants to look it up on a mapping service, you can get real specific about where I was. I was born at the end of the civil rights movement and getting into like the disco era and the 70s and the oil crisis. There's a lot of ways to mark the time, but one of the ways to mark the time is drugs. And the rise of crack cocaine in particular coincides with the rise of me as a person. I grew up with crack. And I remember a version of my neighborhood that was mostly fun and love and like good times. And then I remember a version that became literally more dangerous. I remember my friends being recruited by their older brothers into drug dealing. I remember police raids next door across the street. I remember shootings involving rivals over territory. I would learn much later in life, within the past 3 years, in fact, went back home and talked to a classmate of mine. Months after I moved out, there was maybe the largest raid, certainly at that time, that had ever happened. It was 400 law enforcement officers descended on my block.
Oh my gosh.
My block. Not the whole...
Right, not the neighborhood.
Neighborhood, not Northwest. My block. Joint task force of DEA, FBI, DC police to break up a gang who I knew members of. They were my friend's older brothers. And they were involved in things well above their pay grade in terms of the levels of... It was like cartel levels of... There were beheadings. There was like crazy stuff. So I also...
Wow.
I gotta imagine that my mother was shielding me from a lot. Like I know a lot because you can't hide everything from a child. But I just learned about this as an adult reading newspaper archives a few years ago. So that was a part of the life.
How did you avoid it?
Man, my mother was Arnita Lorraine Thurston. She has a whole name. She had a whole life before I was ever a thought. And she dedicated much of her life to keeping me safe. My older sister, Belinda, 9 years ahead of me. That's a huge enough gap that she was conscripted into pseudo parenthood at times to take care of me and keep me safe. So part of what that meant is, why don't you join this Boy Scout troop and get out, go camping, be anywhere but here, join this after school program. I was a part of so many extracurricular programs. There was an air and space club in my public elementary school, mostly black and brown kids. We had an air and space club and I met the Tuskegee Airmen when I was like 8 years old. And we went to the Air and Space Museum on a regular basis, and I wanted to be an astronaut.
That's my favorite museum.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
So I'm out here hiking. I'm on the computer. My mom brought a computer home. So I'm spending time on the computer, spending time on trails, spending time with my friends, and then I got a job. So there was no time.
What was your first job?
Oh, I worked in an office of a friend's mom doing stupid paperwork. The most legitimate first job I had, where I had a pay stub. Like I had to stick a thing into a machine in the wall and it stamped it. The Washington Post.
Okay.
I worked in something called the Copy Aid Station. It was the internal support group, mostly journalism college students.
Yeah.
But because of the fancy high school I ended up going to, there was like a pathway where one kid figured out how to do an internship there. And sorry, it's not an intern. That was the difference. It was just a job.
Nope.
It wasn't an internship. And so at the end of a long day at high school, I would clock in and work at night at the Washington Post and deliver internal memos. I'd work weekends and school breaks. And I did it for years. I met Ben Bradley, then owner and publisher, on the phone by yelling at him because we were all joking around. You got to imagine, like, I'm 16 and I'm hanging out. All my coworkers are college students or slightly older.
Right.
So the youngest is 20. And then maybe up to 26. And here I am 16. So I'm learning how to joke inappropriately from my big work brothers and sisters. And we were just cracking up. And actually, I think we were listening to the Jerky Boys, these clowns from back in the day, these prank calls. They published cassette tapes and then CDs. And I was mid-laugh at a Jerky Boys joke. And I just screamed, damn, right into the phone. I happened to pick up the phone. And the voice on the other end says, "What's going on down there?" And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Who is it? This is Ben Bradley, the publisher.
But you didn't lose your job.
No, I didn't.
How'd you talk your way out of it?
I apologize. I'm sorry, sir. We're having a really good time down here. That was totally inappropriate. Well, how can I help you? Get him back on whatever his task was. Make his life easier. He needs to be asking much higher level questions than what are you doing down there?
What are you all laughing at?
Yeah.
My first work experience was in a newsroom.
Wow.
In the little NBC affiliate in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yeah.
That's why I work in news today. But I was 16 years old, and it's really unique because everybody's older than you, and then you end up, you learn the inappropriate things that go on in workplaces.
Absolutely.
I used to go out after the newscast. I did the same thing you did, high school, and then I'd go to work and I'd work through the evening newscast we go out drinking with the news team. And, at that point you're sitting next to the guy who anchors the news. No one's going to card you.
Right.
He's with the news people. He's got to be old enough.
Exactly. The extension of trust.
Yes.
But I love for learning these things we have in common. John, just how are we recording? Great. I got to check.
This is why I stalked you, because I knew we would have these commonalities.
And for the people who are hearing this version, the first version was definitely better, but this is really good stuff.
It
wasn't. I just want them to feel bad, like they missed out on something epic.
No, well, Randy would be thrilled to hear that.
This is
better.
We've lost something, but we didn't cover this ground. And so I'm learning this stuff about you right now, and I think you're learning some stuff about me right now, and that's a lot of fun.
Well, that's, honestly, it's why we've had conversations about it. We're coming up on our 150th podcast.
Oh.
This may be 149.
148, I think.
It's 148, okay.
So
yeah.
The thing that I love about doing it, and we've had conversations like, are we going to keep going? There are always people to have these kinds of conversations. Yeah. I learned so much, and it's just so refreshing to me. So that's why, this is the nexus of why we do this show.
Yeah, I feel it.
Right here.
I feel it. Well, again, I'm glad to be doing it with you.
All right, so you've got the thing with the Onion coming up. You're still deeply immersed in life with machines.
Yes.
What brought you to Palm Springs? And you're involved. Like, you didn't just come here and hang out.
Yeah. No, I put down a mortgage and pay property taxes, too.
That makes us all involved.
Literally invested in this community. not just Airbnb taxes for this
one. But you jumped on the technology.
Yeah, I was dragged on by Peter, but I didn't run away. And so we came to Palm Springs. Elizabeth and I came here. She has a history here well before we even met.
Okay.
She and I met in 2014. I was in New York. She was in LA. And we met at a party. And it's a whole fun story. We can tell it off mic. But
I want to hear what you told
me. For the sake of time, I'll just say she was the first person, the second person to bring me to Palm Springs. My first trip to Palm Springs was in 2003 for a comedy conference. And those things don't go together. But somebody was making a buck off of people who were young and wanted to be better at comedy. And I was looking to learn. So I lived in Boston at the time. I found out about this conference, the California Comedy Conference in Palm Springs, California. I drove a rental car from LA, top down, blasting Outkast. I mean, I remember so much of the scene because it was something I'd never seen before. We stayed at whatever the Riviera is now was something else back then, but right on Indian Canyon near the northern part of town. And I had a roommate.
Okay.
I had a roommate who was so different from me. And he looks a lot like you. He's a bald white guy from Iowa. And you're not told, he was more bald than you. You still got stuff around the sides. He had nothing. And he didn't think racism existed. And he was like, why can't you guys just pull yourselves up by your bootstraps? And I was like, well, do you know how physics works? Like, if you tried doing it. Have you tried pulling yourself up by your boot? He's like, oh, I never tried that. But yeah, it doesn't work. So we had a friendly disagreement about the nature of America and racism, but we also live together. Again, macro, micro stuff. Like that's how the whole society tends to move forward. And then I didn't come back until Elizabeth brought me when we were dating. She had a nice relationship coming out here from LA with her girls. And one of her best friends bought a house. We were living nearby each other in Highland Park, Los Angeles. And this friend spun out and bought this house. And we started coming and visiting. I'm doing weekends, and then we met people. So it was people that brought us here. First, the friend that brought us, and then couples around them, mostly couples, not always, some parents, some non-parents. But we just fell in love with people, and there was a core group of just amazing friends. Most of them had known each other for a long time, and they welcomed us. And so we've gone on vacations together. We support them. I mean, they're local business owners. They run, I don't know if I should put them all on blast, but they're lovely people. And
Come on, give them a shout out.
Okay, so Adelie Lapamook and Adnan Lapamook. Adnan runs Consist, and Adelie runs the ice cream and shop at the Arrive Hotel.
Oh, very cool.
All right, you got Anna, Annalisa and Sean Hollebeck, who own Elizabeth and Prince, a retail shop on right on El Paseo.
Yeah.
A block from where we are right now. And in Palm Springs, you've got Engen, who has Sandfish. You've got Patrick and Anita Service. Patrick owns one of the restaurants.
Las Cazuelas.
Las Cazuelas.
The Terraza
of Las Cazuelas. You got Brianna and Tizoc de Aslan, who grew up out here, and they have they work all these big events for the tennis tournament, beautiful floral arrangements, and political consulting work.
It's often on Eye on the Desert. He does a Day of the Dead event.
Yeah, the Run de los Muertos.
Run de los Muertos.
So we make sure to be here for Run de los Muertos, to be here for the Mobius Festival, which happens between the weekends of Coachella. We've got Kenya Knight, who had a really beautiful Moroccan shop, and she was like the queen of the desert. She was one of the first people we knew to move out here full time from LA, and she's been here 20 years or something. So I think I've named somebody I left out. You can hate me because that wasn't the goal here. But it does. And Sunny, you know, Sunny brought us out here, Sunny Brooke Jones. So that kind of crew, and there's been others who we learned since then, made it feel like home. And then we found a great house. And it was during COVID, and money didn't cost anything. So the interest rate's low. So we could never, ever, 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 ever leave.
No, my wife are on the same boat. She said to me not too long ago, she's like, oh, this is a really gorgeous house right over here. And that's not too, I'm like, no way.
Yeah.
We're never leaving this house.
Exactly.
My mortgage is 2.75. I'm never leaving.
You got us beat. So, and then Peter Lafort was one of the early people, and his wife, Sally, they came in from Seattle. They've been doing back and forth, but they became full-timers well before us. And Peter was part of this welcoming committee. So I was playing pickleball on a regular with Adnan and Peter. And that was some of my early like community building out here. And we were talking about AI. And so it was out of those conversations that Peter was really part of the Life with Machines origin story.
Gotcha.
Because he built the thing I buried in this long conversation is beautiful. Our show, we do everything I talked about, but we also do it with AI, not just using ChatGPT to help like edit scripts, with an AI character named Blair, who we created as a co-producer on the show, to help us explore and experiment with what is it like to move from tool to teammate or code to colleague, because we think that's where it's going, because Peter thinks that's where it's going.
Mm.
And so he was experimenting with us and through us on traveling to the future and seeing what it's like. It's the same thing that got him to really push for the AI Creativity Expo in Palm Springs last year, which is coming up again this June. So how do we taste this future and decide if that's what we want to eat?
You're dabbling in it.
Yeah.
Don't worry, John. I don't want an AI, John. I like you.
Oh, thanks.
I don't.
I hadn't told you or Randy about Fiona yet.
Fiona?
Yeah.
Do we have is she a co-host?
She helps me.
Fiona
helps. See? Everybody's got somebody on the side in the digital realm. So Palm Springs really attracted me for that. And then the nature was a huge part of it. And they were still learning into this, but connecting with indigenous communities, I got a good chance to do that in my youth with my mom. She had some curiosity in that regard that was like respectful. America Outdoors pushed it even further. And there's one thing I'll tell you about toward the very end that I'm working on that's related to what I'm up to next. I think
we are close to the very end.
Okay, great, great.
I don't want to, I mean, we.
Oh, he's like, then you should do it now if you want to
do it now.
So cue patriotic music in the background. And I will front load this by saying what I'm about to say is not political, but it is communal in that we are in the 250th birth year of the United States of America.
We are indeed.
The Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. And so 2026 is a big moment. And I've been thinking about it. I've been working with people who've been thinking about, well, how do we celebrate this? And what are we celebrating? And what do we want for the next 250 years or even the next 50 days after that? There's a lot of uncertainty going on. So there's a beautiful history of democracy that was already here before any explorers from Europe arrived. And part of who Benjamin Franklin and them, that's how you refer to the founders, by the way, Benjamin Franklin and them, part of their crew linked up with the crews that were here, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, to be specific by name. And so we've been working with elders from those indigenous nations, Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora, to elevate that history and expand the founding story to remind folks of what else is possible in terms of the principles we govern ourselves by. And it's really a beautiful thing to look back at U.S. history and find something surprising and good. Mostly when it was going to these historic moments and we're like, oh, there's a massacre I didn't know about. The greatness was so front loaded that we can generally only find out bad news about the people that we laud and
right.
love.
That is so
and
true.
And you're like, oh, are we going to have to cancel so-and-so? We're changing street names, right? There's all this stuff. And this is one of those stories where it's just upside. It's better than we know. Our founding story is bigger than we know, and it's better than we know. And so I've been working with a group of these folks, these elders from this history, on a book called American Indigenous Democracy, A Call for Interdependence. And it's touching on a lot of what we've talked about here, even what we've demonstrated with each other. How do we live well together? And what can we call on to give us that strength now? Because we're in a really volatile, unpredictable, too violent, and divided time. And it doesn't have to be that way. And it turns out it hasn't always been that way, even when there's been people of vast difference living in the same land. So we want to remind folks of that history, invite us into something more beautiful together. And when you do your show notes and whatnot, I'll give you the links, but that book is available. And there's a short URL if that moves you, bit.ly/AID, that's all capital, aid, and then book, lowercase. So AID book, American Indigenous Democracy book. And you can find out more and see if it tastes good to you. Is that the future you want to taste?
We will put all that up when we post this.
Yeah.
I know it's going to be more work for you, John, but
more work. But that's going to keep him having a job. Plus, he's just going to get Fiona to do it.
I know. Fiona's going to end up doing it. Poor Fiona.
John is making 10 other podcasts that you don't even know.
I know he is. I know. I'm worried what else he's having Fiona do. I am so in love with your thoughtfulness.
Oh, thank you.
And you are. My takeaway today is that you're so driven by people.
Yeah.
Not just the people you work with, but the people you surround yourself with.
Yeah.
And I love every time you talk about your mom, the love and the respect comes through. And it's just really impressive.
Thank you for feeling that. I remembered the friend that's going to be mad that I didn't mention.
Okay.
Her name is Arlene. She works for in a gallery with Philip. I don't even know Phil's last name, but he owns a gallery down in Palm Desert. And Arlene is the best. You know who I'm talking about.
I
know
do,
who
and I can't tell you, but
Phil, you know this town.
Yeah, he's been on the desert before.
And I'm just like, Arlene, don't be mad at me. Don't be mad at me.
Don't be mad at it. It was me. I told him to name names. Yes, so it's my fault. You can be mad at me.
Oh, goodness. So listen, y'all. John, thank you.
Thank Randy, you.
You're not here, but thank you. Patrick, thank you.
It's entirely my pleasure.
Yeah.
And even though we had a snafu and had to do it twice, I'm kind of glad.
Me too. No, yeah. I feel more connected.
Look, Bertundi is probably the busiest man on earth because it took a lot of coordination to get you back in here.
I quote unquote live in Palm Springs, but I travel a lot.
But I will tell you, it was so worth it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
So worth it.
Great.
To get you back in here. And in our 150, I don't think we've ever actually repeated it.
This actually is episode number 149.
Woo! Precipice.
All right.
Right on the precipice.
I went and just checked it.
Okay, so thank you very much for being part of our first 150 episodes. You're one of those guests, we could have you back next week and it would be an entirely different podcast. That's right. You just are involved in so much and I really love it. We miss Randy. Sorry he couldn't be here, but Butters needed to get him trained in obedience, so that's important. John, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My thanks to the entire team here at Skip's Little Bar. They take good care of us. And Bertundi, thank you so much. And if we're looking forward, I can't wait to see what you're going to be doing with the onion. So that's going to be...
yes, me too.
Just Google Bertundi and onion, and when it happens, we're all going to know about it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode of Big Conversations Little Bar.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all in between. Far.
big conversations. Little Bar.